My name is Joe Harvey Allen, and it's questionable what I do. I'm really good at sitting in this spot and daydreaming. I sit in this spot a lot and look right out that window.
Oh, it's a great view.
I'm an actress, and I write some.
All right. When did you first start writing in any way, shape, or form? Do you remember?
I always wrote in diaries when I was a kid.
Ah, the diaries. Do you still keep a diary?
And I still write in journals, and I don't write every day.
Yeah.
But sometimes I play catch up, but I've always kept journals.
Do you feel comfortable telling the story about the beautiful waitress and how that came up?
But I did a radio show in L.A. Terry came home one day and said, you know, you're going to be boring staying home with kids all the time. And I said, oh, no, I'm going to radio school. I just, like, made it, never thought of it once in my life. I made it up on the spot. So the next day he came in and he said, well, I got you a radio show.
In Los Angeles.
In L.A.
Right.
On the first underground rock station.
Oh, yeah.
So my grandmother was very, I had these colorful grandmothers, and everybody was storytellers in my family, and really wonderful, tradition of just sitting on the porch telling stories, and on pallets under the stars telling stories. And so anyway, I just went and did this radio show and told weird stories about my family. And there weren't any women then doing radio.
Yeah.
And nobody heard of anyone as crazy as my family. So we just had musicians out there, and we did that show, which was country and rock people would come and tell stories. And then after that, we had Bernie Pearl's blues show. And then after that, the Firesign Theater.
Oh.
So that was all day Sundays in L.A.
Wow.
So that was the first time I started kind of producing and putting stories with music. So that was just a little bit of edging toward writing and making things and making them fit. And it was pretty loose, but we would go to Louisiana and interview the snake people. So I started interviewing, and you know, everything just started kind of adding up like that.
Yeah.
And then we left L.A. I always wanted to be an actress, although I had no training. You know, I just wanted to be a movie star, really.
Sure.
That was it. And so there was no hope in hell of doing that. So I was sort of running with a fast crowd of actors and all, and I was overcome with it. And I sort of got to look at myself and pull myself together and said, you know, I really want Little League ball games, and I better get out of L.A. So I talked Terry into moving back to Lubbock.
Well, what year would this be?
This was in 1969. And I was going around with false eyelashes on the bottom. Thank God I was saved. Barely had my ass covered and had false eyelashes. Anyway, so basically I started thinking, if I'm going to do anything, I'm going to have to do it myself, or it's not going to happen. And I got asked to do this interview with Waylon Jennings. Terry was going to the first Willie Nelson picnic. And so I thought, well, that'll be good. I'll go interview. That'll give me something to do. I'll go interview Waylon Jennings. And because I'm totally out of radio. You know, I was supposed to have a syndicated show, and when we went to Lubbock, they had heard that I said Lubbock was the wettest, dry town in the whole world. And they wouldn't let me use their equipment because I'd said that about Lubbock. So I lost the whole syndicated radio show. Couldn't do the weather, lost the radio show anyway. So I was very thrilled to have this interview with Waylon Jennings. And I'm talking to Waylon, who I just thought was the coolest person.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to him for 2 hours. And then he says, oh, you know, I've got to go. I've got an interview with some girl. And I go, oh my God, I'm not showing up.
Because you're the girl.
I'm the girl. Yeah. And I'm not going to show up. So I didn't get my interview. And yeah. So Terry and I were in a cafe in Lubbock. And I said, I was just miserable, you know, just whining around because I didn't have my interview with Waylon. And Terry said, why don't you talk to this waitress? She's probably just as interesting as Waylon. Why do you have to interview somebody famous anyway? And so this waitress kind of bopped over really cheerful to the table. And I said, could I come over to your house? And she said, well, sure, you know. And so I went to her house after thinking she was this upbeat, terrific person. And I sat on the porch with her little kids waiting for her to come home from work. And the kids hadn't eaten. They had had French fries. They borrowed 15 cents from a neighbor the day before and had gotten French fries. And we sat on the porch of this little house waiting for her to come. And when she finally showed up, she had a black eye and blood on her face. And she had been in a bar. And she sat down and started talking about her life. And I went back 2 days talking to her, trying to figure out how she could get out of this hole that she was in. And I just realized how impossible, how deep in she was, and the situation so bad. But I became really interested in it. When I first went, I was really, it was just sort of like, you know, Terry just said, why don't you interview her? And I was just very flip about it, you know. But then I got very interested in just her. And I said, well, I'll come back to Texas. And I started keeping up with her and trying to find out about her life. I decided to write the waitress book.
And you already had one interview.
And I had one interview. And so I went back and I first thought, you know, I'll just do a photo book. But I just got more and more and more into the waitresses.
Yeah.
And I had the most incredible, wonderful times working at truck stops. And I worked at one place where there was a big tank. It was the Sheraton, and all the tables were bugged.
Bugged.
You know, the mafia would go into restaurants and they would bug all of these places. I mean, it is true. It is very true. The first waitress I interviewed in California had worked at a place that all of the tables were bugged. All the real estate people went. And they knew every deal in town. So anyway, I worked at this very crazy, you know, cocktail lounge. And then I worked at the truck stop where all the waitresses and the truckers were feuding. And I saw it on television. It was in the San Joaquin Valley with 75 diesels, you know. And this big truck stop, all the waitresses were prostitutes. And I went out there and got a job. And it was such a fantastic experience for me.
Yeah.
Learning about just the whole, you know, I thought at that time that people could watch TV or they could make big improvements in their life. They could see how other people lived and imitate that and get themselves out of these situations. Working on that book, I realized by the, you know, grace of God, you have a shot at something that other people really can't do or get to.
Or even envision.
Even have. I worked with a waitress that I just loved, Little Mary, and she had 5 kids by the time she was 21, working as a prostitute, and had stopped to get this job at the truck stop because she didn't want her kids taken away. And I went to her house, which had been condemned, and she showed me you know, all the improvements that she had made, bought her mother a gas range from Sears and put shag carpet on the floor. And, you know, they had been eating in the front yard on the hibachi before that. And all the things that she was doing, I realized she was doing more in her life than I had ever accomplished in mine. So it really gave me an insight into people that up until then I didn't have. So it was very lucky to do that. And I started really loving that process of interviewing people. And as I put these interviews together, I would do... I did that old way of, you know, with my little recorder back and forth, and I put every inflection, everything, in word for word in the interviews. And I love these women so much that it sounded like poetry to me. So I put all of their words in verse form.
Yeah.
And then I had to write a foreword. And it was so sparse, my writing. That, and I think that was because I had a limited vocabulary and had a tendency to make up words.
Yeah.
Anyway, I realized I actually had a style that was very sparse and of my own writing. And Terry said, you should go study poetry. So Philip Levine lived there.
Oh.
So I studied poetry with Philip Levine,
one
of the best.
Yeah.
And I took some of these, would write some of these things from the truck stop. And he was looking at the writing that I was doing of these waitresses and the poetry and all. And he had suggested that I go to Port Townsend. And that's where I met your friend, Tom Robbins, to a writer's workshop in Port Townsend.
Uh-huh.
And I met Kenneth Rexroth there. And studied with both Rexroth and Philip Levine. Rexroth asked me to go on the road and do poetry readings with him. So this was all a new world to me.
Yeah.
And it gave me just enough confidence to start doing readings. And when I was there, I was listening to other poets do their readings of their poems. And so many good poets were boring me stiff with their readings. And I thought, I'm just never going to do a poem that I have to read. If I can't memorize a short poem, forget it. So eventually, I was traveling and doing poetry. And I was in Houston. And I was doing a deal on the radio. And I was reciting some poetry, and all of a sudden I just started singing. I couldn't really justify doing one poem without the song, and it just started to open up like that. And so I did my first poetry performance in San Francisco.
Really? Do you remember where?
I did it at 80 Langdon, and I wrote them a letter. It was an alternative gallery. And I wrote him a letter and I said, I've scrubbed the bathroom floor over 1,000 times and I'm ready to move on. And I want to do this poetry performance. At the same time, something else had happened that was really influential. And that Yvonne Rainer, Terry was teaching school at Fresno State, and Yvonne Rainer had just made a movie of a woman who, that was just wonderful. And she was teaching a class. She was the guest artist at Fresno State. And no one was taking her class. And so I decided that I would go out there and perform for Yvonne Rainer and get her input. So I stayed up 2 nights straight and did a performance just for her. So that was really the first performance I ever did. And she really encouraged me and worked with me during the short time she was there to go and do my own work. And so with her input and help, and she said, just use what you know. Use these poems. Use what you're doing and go make a piece of your own. And so that's when I went to San Francisco to do that. And I was just a nervous wreck doing it.
Yeah.
But it was called A Moment's Hesitation, and it was all poetry. But I performed it. So I was crawling around with bloody knees, setting fires on the floor and doing my poetry. Well, all the poets that had been supportive of me doing poetry readings and when I would just do it, just hated it. They wouldn't come. They didn't see it. They hated it anyway. They just thought it was complete bullshit, you know. And I always thought it was because it was just that whole world was a bit provincial, I think. And to do something like that where you're crawling around doing your poems and all was just like, you know, oh my God. So anyway, but I got lucky and I got asked to go to New York and do the play. I never thought I would ever do it again. And I started traveling that play. And I left the poems in the bathroom. I was doing the play at the one place at the museum in Santa Barbara. And I left all my poems in the bathroom, and someone found them and published them. Dirk Robinson. So that's how I got my poems published.
Do they credit you?
He gave me a call and said, I'm publishing these poems, okay?
All right.
And did a great job making a book. But it's just, you know, I've just been so lucky how things have happened. It just, I never intended to do it again.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I was in New York doing it. And then all over the place. Next play was Duck Blind, and I did it in L.A. And you know what was interesting about that is that every time I do something, it comes from a completely different place. I had studied to be an interior designer, and I was drawing a room when I got the idea for the play. The way it all comes is from outer space,
it's magic.
Somewhere. It's just magic, you know. But so I had started doing these. It bordered on performance art. The first one was poetry. The second one, I started incorporating dreams and writing more. And just making this up and doing this theater piece. And then it was about that time that I got invited to go. It's all a hodgepodge in my mind, what was happening first. But I got invited to go, and no, I take it back. I had already started the Waitress book.
Yeah.
So I was working on the Waitress book then. And it was after that first play that then I really got into the book. So I was writing and performing and traveling plays, working on the Waitress book at the same time, really. And the Waitress book, I got a great literary agent in New York and got opportunities to publish it once I had finished it. And there were about 30 women that ended up being in the first part of this book called The Beautiful Waitress. And every publisher wanted me at that time to put a foreword. There were about 3 different people who wanted to publish this book. And they really basically wanted me to say, these poor downtrodden women.
Right.
You know, underpaid, overworked, blah, blah, blah. The women's, whole women's. Time of the women's movement, the beginning of that. And I just said, that's not who these women are. Each one is so unique and you can't judge them. I mean, the women were, some of them, one woman had been a waitress for 40 years working double shifts and said, it's a blessing of my life. And they were just all different. One was you know, said I was always she was the valedictorian. She said I was a smart duck. Now I'm a foxy chick. Now I'm liberated, you know. So I just said, you cannot label these women, you know. And so I just put the book under the bed. And Joan Tewksbury came to visit. She was talking to Terry about in Fresno to do some project. And Joan was the only woman that I knew working in Hollywood. And she was the busiest woman director at that time. She had written Nashville and working with Altman on Thieves Like Us. And she came to Fresno, and I took her out to a cemetery to pick her brain and just parked the car and said, how do you do all these things? And I realized that she was taking the bus in L.A. When I had a bug, I had a little Volkswagen, and I went, my God, she didn't have any edge. So, you know, you can do what you want to do, you know.
Right.
So Joan, I ended up pulling this waitress stuff out from under the bed to show to Joan. And she said, well, here's your next play. You've got it. And that plus this string of unbelievable, beyond synchronicity miracles that were happening that kept pointing to all of this stuff, I started putting all of that together and wrote the first play, which was called Tables and Angels, and first performed making a composite character from about 30 of those women.
And
it was word for word.
And first performed?
And performed at the Chat and Chew Cafe,
right,
in Anchorage, Alaska. This place with the big chicken.
Yeah.
And I went in, and when Ruby Kay was the name of the character.
What year would that be?
I have no earthly idea. It was sometime in the 70s.
Okay.
And so I went to the chicken burger with all this material. We were in Alaska. And This, and I was doing it on my own then. It was my piece. I hadn't worked. I eventually asked Joan to direct it when it started touring and going on. But I did it at this chicken burger, and I went and asked Naomi and Fonzo, who own the Chicken Burger Cafe, if I could do a play in their cafe. And they said they had to hear it first. And the first lines when Ruby Kay comes out is exactly a word of a waitress. And she goes, I will never get married. 13, I married a chicken shit. Got pregnant, you know, blah, blah, blah. And Ruby Kay cussed just like a sailor. And Fonzo is just shaking his head, you know, like, I'm not going for this. And I just said, Fonzo, give me 15 minutes. And after about 15 minutes of listening to Ruby Kay cussing and carrying on, he said, you know, I'm beginning to like the old gal. And so I did it with real people in the cafe, real truckers coming in. And I started the play by walking up to some guy who pulled up in a truck. And I climbed up on his truck and I said, I haven't seen you in 10 damn days. I said, get in here. I just missed the hell out of you. Let's go eat some pie. And I walked in with this guy who didn't know me from Adam. So I did the play behind the counter with Naomi and Fonzo cooking, and me waiting on half people who knew I was doing a play and half people who had no earthly idea what was going on. And then I did it at some other place. I did it at the Chat and Chew in San Francisco like that. And then I asked Joan to direct it and did it in L.A. and then started traveling it all over the country, you know. We took it to New York. But it was the first play that I did that set up sort of a pattern that I started interviewing and doing word for word these characters. And I sort of became singled out for presenting characters without any judgment. That they were almost documentary.
Yeah.
It was almost documentary work because I just never changed a word. There was not one word in Counter Angel that wasn't something a waitress had said to me. And then the next play, I started interviewing tent revivalist preachers, women. And I took all of those interviews and made Hallie Lou, another composite character out of those. And I did that first beside a roaring river in Aspen, Colorado, and had a 13-foot king cobra in the play. And it was all...
A live one?
A live one. And it was all... It was about a snake handler because I had run into all of these people and put all of these interviews together. And it was a fiction in that I made this work, but it was so real because it was really their sermons. It was really their words. I never changed any of their words. I just pieced it together. And so I preached off the back of a flatbed truck with these towering crosses out by river. Some kid heard me rehearsing, and he was walking across this huge field. And it was at night, and I'm out there with the snake preaching, and this kid just ran like tickets through there and scared the hell out of
me. Yeah.
But when I was doing it, someone, they knew it was a play, but then someone came up to be saved.
Mm.
It was just like a very bizarre, when I did the waitress play, restaurants were letting the waitresses off work, and they would come in groups and throw roses. They really appreciated. You'd go into a cafe and the waitress would hate you, like, what are you doing? And then you would start to do the play and they knew it was true.
Yeah.
And so they would appreciate that you were there.
Because it they were appreciated.
Probably because they were being honored.
Yeah.
And the stories were so, their lives were so really magnificent and beautiful. Yeah. And tragic and great. A few years ago, I found about six of those women.
Oh.
And I also took photographs of them for the book. And a friend of mine was here, and she looked at the photographs and the old book, which I never published. I put it away. And she looked at the book and the photographs and said, can I do something with these photographs? So she restored them. And she had a show in at the Bemis, a wonderful center in Omaha. And Terry said, I think you should go to this show. So I went, and she had taken my photographs and had them blown up huge, each photograph, and put the booklet, I think that you got the catalog together for me with the CD from the performance of Counter Angel.
It's a stunning cover photo of the largest beehive hairdo I've ever seen, which immediately brought to mind the apocryphal story of the Black Widow that's...
In the beehive. Exactly. Now this woman, how I met the woman, her hair was this high.
Yeah.
And she had on a mini skirt and she leaned over with her boobs.
Right.
And her cat-eye glasses looking out over them. And she was at a restaurant. Well, it was sort of a restaurant. It turned into a whorehouse after lunch. sort of a restaurant in Houston that we went to for lunch. And then I started eyeing all these incredible waitresses and went back after lunch by myself to get interviews with them. And this woman, got up on the table and started doing a strip. And I thought she was a waitress, and she wasn't. She said, I'm a waitress somewhere else. I don't even work here. I'm just doing this. But I was talking to all the waitresses in there, and her story, she said to me, if anybody wrote a book about me, honey, that thing would be a bestseller. So I started following her around, and she was unbelievable. It ended up, you saw her with all that hair, and everything. False eyelashes, all this. I mean, the people were so amazing. I had photographs of her with straight, slick back hair, no wig. Unrecognizable, you know, the two photographs. You saw in the book how they're totally, I mean, you would never know it was the same person. And she became a saint, taking in everybody's unwanted kids. So you could not make judgments about these people once you started to get to know them. It was like what I thought about her when I met her and what I thought about her
after
I knew her. Miles and miles. I mean, and that was the case of everybody that I interviewed. I would start interviewing people. And I would go in and I would say, here's my recorder. And then I would say, this is going to make you nervous. And I'd put it in a mesh bag and hide it. And I would say, don't tell me anything I can't use. And I would start talking to them about being kids and what they were like as kids. And then as I went back, day after day, they would tell me more and more. And then there would come a time when they really didn't like me, because they had divulged too much. And then we got over that hump. But I would go back over several years interviewing these same people before I would get, what, 5 pages on them.
Yeah.
So that process is something that I think it's influenced my work more than anything. It's just talking to people and having this idea, really, that everybody is so interesting. It's like just the more you talk, the more you find out. I mean, the more you listen, the more time you give someone, it's just mind-boggling, their lives. And really, you can make a great story out of anybody's life. So I wrote a lot of plays. And did them. I did a lot of interviews. Some of the work was almost like stand-up, because it would just be characters that I would just do. One show I did, As It Is in Texas, and this was all in the 70s. And so then I started in my plays. I would incorporate dreams. I would put in my own poetry. I would put in these characters. It just all started to build and build like that. And then David Byrne came to one of my plays. And that was a funny story, because David, I was doing a play in Fullerton, California at the college. I was doing stand-up of this, As It Is in Texas, a string of these Texas women I'd interviewed. And David, when I got back to this, they had put me up in just the worst motel. You know, the carpet was rolling up. And I didn't even have a rental car, you know, and I'm doing it in this school, for this school. And when I get to the, motel where I'm staying, the guy at the desk says, this guy, David Byrne, has been calling you all day long. And I go, oh my God, a stalker. Who would track me to this terrible motel? And I wrote his number on a McDonald's sack and threw it in the trash. And the next morning, I sort of got my curiosity up because it was daylight. And I thought, I'll just call this person. And he's going, well, I know somebody that you know, and blah, blah. And I'm going, oh, perfect stalker line, you know.
Right.
And he's going, I want to come to the play tonight. And I go, oh, I couldn't possibly tell you how to get there. And I was really rude to him on the phone. And then he comes to the play. And he comes up and I go, well, what have you ever done before? He goes, oh, well, a few music videos, you know. And I go, well, you're not a real movie maker. Yeah. He told me he was making a movie. And I go, well, you're not a real movie maker. And then, so I was just really mean to him. I didn't realize it was the David Byrne.
Right. You know?
But anyway, he asked me to be in his movie. And he said, you could play all these parts. And I'm giving him a very hard time. You know, if you want me to be in your movie, because I didn't think he had ever done anything, I just said, you know, you better just send me the script right now, and I may look at it, and I might not. I'm being really haughty about it, because yeah. I really sort of think he's still a stalker. And so anyway, he sends me this. And I think I'm supposed to be playing all the parts in the movie of True Stories.
Yeah.
Because he said you can play any of these parts.
Right.
And so my main concern was to also play the male preacher. So I had my hair all slicked back trying to do the male preacher. But anyway, that was my first film, was wow. with David. And David was so fabulous that... he would let me look through the camera at every shot, practically. And he let me write a lot of my own lines, which was great. And toward the end of it, he was shooting a scene, and I said, well, don't you want to hear my ideas? And he said, no, just shoot it. So it was a great first film and really wonderful lucky break for me. So my dream of acting sort of, it just sort of fell in my lap. You know, I think the one of the great gifts that my family gave me was my mother always said, you're no better and you're no worse than anybody else. And I just always just went where I wanted to go. You know, I didn't have sense enough to know I didn't belong there. And I didn't have sense enough to know I shouldn't be there.
Joe Harvey, thank you.
Thank you.
And we're out of tape.